EFT, Champaign, 90.1 FM, streaming online at weft.org. I am Eunice Buckner Boone, and this is my turn for Higher Ground. We'll start off with a little tribute to Natalie Cole, Getting Ready. And as always, the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Today is, wow, January, is it the 8th or the 9th? Let's see. It's the 9th, my goodness. It's January 9th, 2016. Okay.
Finish it all. Get ready, because right now, in a very moving musical tribute to my friend Natalie Cole, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome none other than Miss Rochelle Farrell and Miss Deborah Cox.
I've got love on my mind. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the 1999 recipient of the Soul Train Leader of Souls Award, the Lena Horne Career Achievement Award, electro recording star, our sister beloved, Natalie Cole.
I really thought that I was going to be very, very okay with this. this evening. But the truth is, you guys, in a lot of ways, this is where it all started for me, with the help of people like Don Cornelius. And of course, you guys. I mean, you guys are just amazing. You know, it's not easy being and doing what it is that I do, that we do, those of us that you kind of pinpoint and think we're in that other arena of life. And but I just want you to know that sometimes it's so difficult, so much responsibility, so much stuff. And it's when I get around my people that I realize that it's okay. It's really okay. It is a fact that you people keep me grounded. Thank you very much for that. Really. We have come so far. We have come so far. It's hard to believe that I've been in this business 25 years with all my stuff and all my difficulties, my triumphs and my tragedies, and you have not let me down. You have not let go of my hand. I thank you for that. I want to send out for immediate thanks to, of course, Mr. Don Cornelius, to Miss Sylvia Roan for making this night possible. I love you. Thank you very much. She's been a wonderful friend. There are too many people to thank, but some of my family's in the audience, particularly my son, Robert Adam Yancey, who you've also watched grow up. And I'm glad to say that he will very likely be following in the footsteps of his grandfather and his mom. Thank you that you have given me this award, because when I was a little girl, Lena Horne was a friend of our family's, and she was, to me, the most, certainly at least one of the most elegant women, not just black women, one of the most elegant women that I had ever had the opportunity to meet. And I really am very honored and will cherish this very much. There is nothing pat about receiving an award from your people, because you don't have to do that. You have been most kind and generous. I always feel the love. And I want to, last of all, thank God for bringing me this far. Still stepping, y'all. Still stepping, still moving on. And please, please, to those who come after me, after us, to the ones that are coming up now, please remember who you are. Don't let anyone tell you that you are not the most beautiful, proud, gorgeous, courageous, strong, loyal, spiritual, fine, intelligent, smart. Because we know that we are in a business that is very fleeting, just as life is. So get what you can, do something with it, hold on to it, and never, ever forget where you came from. Thank you. God bless you. Thank you so much.
The 5th Annual Soul Train Lady of Soul Awards continue with Deborah Cox.
And that was a tribute to Natalie Cole, who recently died at the age of 65 years. We will miss her. Her music, her legacy. In addition to that, death in the entertainment industry, William Guest, who was a member of Gladys Knight and the Pips. He too died since the last time I was on the radio. And Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, PhD doctor, whom researched probable causes for racism and why racism, using color as an index, is systemic and necessary because of some slight of melanin on the skin or lack of it, one fears their extinction. She wrote a book years ago. Well, when was this book published? The ISIS Papers was quite earth-shattering. 1991, this book was written, or let's see, yeah, copyrighted and written in 1991. So I guess you would say more than 20 years, 25 years, 26. Let's see, this 2000. No. That's more than that. That's over 30 years or more. So yes, she wrote a book called The ISIS Papers, The Keys to the Colors. And Dr. Cress Welsing really shook up a lot of people because, you know, eugenics and dysgenics was something that was also a type of research or study presented that said, well, there's these defects, or there are these retarded or developmental retardations in people. And if that's so, then why not have them castrated or, you know, prevent them from having children? So I'm going to be playing a interview between Tony Brown's. He used to have a radio program, a television program on on public radio station. And this one is in 19, I'm not quite sure what year it was. I think it's been quite a few years, all right? No, I think it was in 1970 something. But this interview was that she had with Tony Brown, but also Dr. Shockley, who was who argued for a type of eugenics that he believed would be useful. And the reason why he thought it would be useful, well, he didn't say eugenics. What he argued was that there are some characteristics about African Americans, or at that time the Negro, that he felt made them a little less, somewhat inferior, these traits. And therefore, because of these traits, you'd want to minimize them having children, if that's what they choose to do, because of these traits. And it wasn't, according to him, not just limited to people of color, but it was to any individual who demonstrated these traits, lack of intelligence or abilities, etc., according to research. So I'm going to be playing that, and I think you'll find that quite interesting. That'll be about 30 minutes long. There's actually another interview that follows that's recorded. This is on YouTube also, but I won't be playing that because at 9 o'clock I have a guest. And the guest is going to be, will be the author. Well, she's not the author of this book, but she is a educator and teacher about this particular approach to learning, to parenting, as well as to in different organizations, they use this method in order to teach emotional intelligence. This philosophy, which is supported by Joshua Freeman, the author of this book, Wholehearted Parenting, How to Use Emotional Intelligence to Create More Peace, Connection, and Joy. My guest will be Deborah Havert, or Havert. She's an educator and master trainer for 6 Seconds, the Emotional Intelligence Network, a nonprofit organization dedicated to emotional intelligence. She'll suggest a better way for parents to handle stress and loneliness with insights from the organization's new book, Wholehearted Parenting, by Joshua Friedman. Deborah Havert offers parents sane and sound advice about how to raise thriving kids. So my focus in this conversation, I hope too, will not be just on parents, how to do that. Because parenting, yes, it requires a great deal of awareness and emotional intelligence. And oftentimes, I think through your children, you do learn to be much more aware and sensitive. But this also is useful in order to for anyone, and it's used in organizations to increase emotional intelligence. And what does that mean? We will discuss that. What is emotional intelligence? Why is it useful? How does emotional intelligence lead to self-awareness, self-management, self-direction? You know, and what are these smart feelings? And how this is useful in your everyday life. I think this is a discussion that I have quite frequently with my clients, as well as with in my personal life, that I'm constantly aware or consciously aware of my feelings, how I'm feeling when I'm speaking to someone else, when I'm sharing space with them. How do I feel about what they're saying? How do I feel about what I'm saying? How does my body feel? What are my thoughts? What's going on? You know, how are my surroundings, my environment? What are my thoughts? Are they about what's going on presently, in addition to what has happened in the past? Am I aware? Am I tired? And when I'm tired, do I respond differently? So we'll be looking at our thoughts, our feelings, and the actions that follow. And this all happens within 6 seconds. And that's why it's called 6 seconds, because we're always influenced by our feelings, whether we are aware of them or not. And also learning how to explore feelings, and not necessarily just react to feelings, but understand the texture and the many different ways in which a feeling is communicating to us. So this should be an interesting conversation with her on the telephone. And that will be coming up at 9 o'clock. She will call. All right. Some more announcements. Let's see. Juanita Moore, I forgot to say, 99-year-old actress. Remember the movie Imitation of Life? Well, she died recently. She was an Academy Award nominee. Juanita Moore. Dr. Khadija Nicole Green has been doing extensive research on cancer using lasers. And she was given a $1 million research grant for cancer treatment to study that. So I think that's somebody you want to explore. Dr. Khadija Nicole Green. You can look her name up and find out a little bit more about some of the things that we're doing in order to encourage the treatment and support the treatment of this cancer without causing so much damage to healthy cells. And also cancer being very debilitating. So in addition, President Obama held a telephone conference with Valerie Jarrett, and I got the ending portion of it yesterday. And this telephone conference was surrounding the executive order where President Obama requires all gun sellers to have licenses and conduct background checks on customers, including gun show transactions and purchases made online. He also called for the hiring of more federal workers to process background checks and provisions to better track lost or stolen guns. And some of the things that was discussed on the radio, I mean on the radio, on this telephone conference was, I've listed it here. Find it. Okay, as I stated, background checks, hiring more agents to keep track of illegal arms and lost and stolen guns, to increase the mental health. They're putting $500 million in mental health funds because two-thirds of gun deaths are through suicides. I don't know if you knew that, but two-thirds of gun deaths are due to suicides. So taking that access to that instrument to kill yourself or to kill, yeah, kill yourself or kill, yeah, that's right, suicidal. And also providing mental health and to teach gun safety technology and research smart gun technology. And that means it's not going to be easy for you to just shoot a gun. So he's calling on everyone in the local communities to organize and mobilize to promote this gun violence, anti-gun violence, and that change must come from citizens because it's through the citizens that legislation is changed. Some of the websites, if you're interested in getting more more information and also to involve yourself in how you can help to make and bring attention, make noise in the direction, speak out how we can prevent gun violence and also how to bring attention to the violence and that reasonable laws must be implemented in order to reduce gun violence. So some of the websites, one is called connect.barackobama, C-O-N-N-E-C-T dot barackobama.com, and that's state and local level. And then there's everytown.org/ACT. And this telephone conference was sponsored by Organizing for Action for Gun Violence Prevention, OFA. Okay, let's see what else. We also know in the newspaper that Carl Hospital, that had been some legislation that was passed, was decided by the Supreme Court as being unconstitutional, because this legislation redefined what was considered nonprofit. And the Supreme Court overturned a decision that made it okay for Carl as well as Prison Hospital to not pay taxes because they provide charitable care. So they would be considered nonprofit. So since 2012, Carl Hospital has not been paying taxes. And this has had a great financial burden on Urbana, because Urbana is where Carl Hospital is. And Carl Hospital occupies a great deal of land, territory, and uses the resources as well as the facilities in order for it to employ people who come from out of town, out of different towns, and they're using resources of the Urbana community without paying any taxes. And it's ridiculous. So that was overturned, and that's a major victory for the mayor of Urbana, Laura Pressing, and all the other persons who were involved in it too, because this was unconstitutional. So there's going to be some money, and this money is going to be there for our schools. in our streets. Repairs. So the burden, once Carl decided and presence decided they weren't paying taxes, then the burden came on Urbana citizens or residents. So, good news. They haven't got any money yet, but of course I'm sure there's going to be some sort of appealing, but that was the Supreme Court that made that decision. Okay, what else do I want to announce? Well, I better not announce too much. I'm going to play a little bit music for music. Let me see, what else do I have here? Just a little bit so I can cue up Dr. Francis Cress Wessling, because I don't want to miss this before my guest calls in at, what time? 9 o'clock. Oh, I have a underwriting announcement to make before I do that, which I'm very thankful for underwriters. Elliott Counseling Group has 30 counselors providing mental health services for individuals, families, couples, children, and groups. Evening and weekend appointments are often available immediately. Virtually all insurance, including state employee insurance, is accepted. There is also a self-pay sliding scale. You can contact Kevin Elliott or his staff at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. That is ELLIOTT CounselingGroup.com or 217-398-9066. That's Kevin Elliott Counseling Group. Okay. Okay, let's see. What do we have here? Playing at the Art Theater beginning January 8th, Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara star in Carol, a film that follows two women from very different backgrounds who find themselves in an unexpected love affair in 1950s New York. This exquisite period piece shows daily throughout the week, and late night programming at the Art returns with Mel Brooks' sci-fi proof spoof, Spaceballs. Can Lone Star and his man-dog sidekick Barf save Princess Vespa from the evil Dark Helmet? Find out Friday and Saturday, the 8th and 9th, and Wednesday and Thursday, the 13th and the 14th, at a bargain price. Okay. We at WEFT are working hard to improve our community radio station. Over the next few months, you will be noticing lots of positive changes in response to your feedback. We ask you to support WEF Vision 2020. If you haven't yet responded to our annual winter appeal, please take a few minutes to make your donations. Contributions can be made easily at www.wef.org/support. If you have made your donation, we thank you. Every penny goes directly into operational costs for WEF and is tax deductible. Visit www.wef.org/support today. Okay, got to get this queued up, and I'll be back with you in very shortly with Dr. Cress Wellsing, Dr. Francis Cress Wellsing, who died recently at the age of 81 or 82. All right, a little bit of music, and I will be back very quickly. Okay, sorry for that brief, that abrupt interruption of that great music by Earth, Wind, and Fire, Mighty Mighty. But I need to do this. I forgot to announce that State Representative Carol Ammons, keynote speaker at the Krannert, will be the keynote speaker at the Krannert for Dr. Martin Luther King Day, 31st Annual Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration Advocacy for Justice. And that will be Sunday, January 17th, 5 to 7 p.m. So that will be at Krannert on January 17th, Sunday, from 5 to 7 p.m. And I'm sure that'll be supported by the community. Sounds like it will be interesting. All right. So I'm going to start with this Dr. Welsing debate with William Shockley, 1974. And we may have to preempt some of it, but we're going to try to get at least the first part. This is on YouTube if you're interested in listening in the future. All right. Here goes.
It is hereditary and racially genetic in origin, and thus not remediable to a major degree by practical improvements in environment.
The long-range implications of what he is doing are no different than the propaganda campaign that Hitler and his Nazi unit carried on in Germany that ended up eliminating 6 million Jewish people. Now, what is most interesting is that Hitler said the very same thing. He said, number one, that the Jews were genetically inferior to the Aryans.
If one believes that the German people would have tolerated the concentration camps and the gas chambers, if news media, like the programs that Mr. Brown is setting on, if those people were willing to bring discordant views out into the open, I don't believe the concentration camps and the gas chambers could have continued to exist in Germany.
Back in the 70s, a man named Dr. William Shockley, a noted scientist, embarked upon the mission of proving to the world that black people are genetically inferior, without, I might add, the benefit of any formal background in genetics. He became front page news and won headlines with his controversial views. On campus after campus, unrest followed his every visit. My position then and now is that if a supremacist cannot be rationally debated, perhaps he has a point. After the debate, you're now going to see, Dr. Shockley went back into oblivion. I don't claim that the 1973 interview did it alone, but I am of the opinion that it helped. I'm Tony Brown. In a moment, Racial Superiority with Dr. William Shockley.
Tony Brown's Journal is brought to you by Pepsi and its bottlers. This program is part of Pepsi-Cola's continuing support of your community's cultural, educational, and business interests.
We have two very prominent educators, scholars on Black Journal tonight. And we feel that it is important to defend the First Amendment rights of all Americans. Dr. William Shockley, one of our guests, has had quite a difficult time speaking at some universities, and particularly some black college students do not agree with his theories. On Black Journal, we feel that Dr. Shockley's rights in the First Amendment area are parallel to black people's rights. That is, that Dr. Shockley must have a platform for his views if black people are to have a platform for their views. Dr. Francis Welsing, on the other side, has difficulty in expressing her views on legitimate mass media outlets because many whites do not agree with her theory of genetics. Now let's find out what the controversy is about. Dr. Shockley, please give us the benefit, basically, of what your theory is.
My principal point, Mr. Brown, is not so much a theory of black-white differences, but is summed up in one word, which is the theme of my appearance on your program and my efforts, and the word is dysgenics. And dysgenics means effectively downbreeding, retrogressive evolution. And I fear that this is worst for the black community, and I particularly welcome an opportunity to appear on Black Journal just for these reasons. And let me say also that when I first met Dr. Welsing, it was not black students who were disrupting, but white students. And Dr. Welsing made a very sincere and I thought extremely effective effort, a well-planned effort. It was not effective with these white students at Staten Island Community College, so I would have a chance to speak. In fact, I think they prevented her from saying what she wanted to say when she was trying to gain me a platform. So my main theme is that we have problems that we should face and we should look at connected with dysgenics, And I welcome any opportunity I have to bring this out so that people can look at it and worry about it.
Dr. Shockley, you are accused of having a theory that is a white racist theory. How do you respond to that?
Well, I respond to that by saying that I've considered whether or not I am a racist. Racist is an epithet that used to damage my self-esteem, but it doesn't anymore. I feel it's untrue. If you look in the dictionary as to what racist means, it means emotional feelings, irrational feelings associated with fear and hate. If I really had those, I don't think I would be here this evening. I feel that what I'm engaged in is a demand for diagnosis, and I'd like to say some more about this chart, which we'll come to probably later, which shows the disproportionate rates of reproduction for the least effective elements of the black community. I'd like to say more about that than we should in just this brief introduction. But I think there is another word that better describes what I'm involved in, and that word is racology, which means a scientific analysis of racial differences. And I basically, I have a faith that reason is a good thing, and I feel as you do about the First Amendment, but maybe with a slightly different emphasis. I think the really important thing about the First Amendment is it is a way of guaranteeing a high likelihood that truth will emerge as a result of conflicting ideas being expressed, and I have a thesis and a basic belief that truth is a good thing and will be of benefit to man.
Thank you. Dr. Francis Welsing, give us the benefit of your theory, please.
Well, my theory was, I wrote the paper in 1969. I wrote a paper called The Crest Theory of Color Confrontation and Racism. And the sole reason behind writing that paper was an attempt to understand the behavior of white people in relationship to all people of color, every place in the world, black, brown, red, and yellow people. And the paper was presented to the Americans at the National Medical Association, the section on psychiatry in neurology, because back in 1969, the black caucus in the American Psychiatric Association, we had said that racism, and when we talk about racism, we're talking about the white supremacy behavior of white people. That racism was the number one mental health problem in the nation, and it was the number one cause of other mental health problems. And I wanted to understand what this thing of racism really is all about, because it's the kind of, it is the thing that has caused woe and misery and suffering for the vast majority of the people on this planet that are classified as non-white. And in my attempt to understand why the necessity of white people to keep saying that white is superior and that the condition of non-white is inferior. And the more I thought about it, in conjunction with an idea that a friend of mine had, that racism was a worldwide behavioral system for the maintenance of white supremacy by a small minority of people, I put those ideas together with what we know about genetics, what we know about the condition of skin whiteness itself. The condition of skin whiteness is the genetic inability to produce skin pigment called melanin. This is a genetic recessive trait. It is a genetic deficiency state, not as defined by Francis Welsing, but defined by geneticists and dermatologists, that the inability to produce the skin pigment of melanin or melanin pigment is described as albinism. And I think that white people, even though most white people are not consciously understanding their problem in genetics, they are certainly aware that they are genetically dominated by people of color. That's why it was a statement, one drop of black blood makes you black, because people of color have the genetic capacity to annihilate white people. And so unless white people control the reproductivity of people of color, then we can postulate that perhaps one day there won't be any white people. And I think that the very survival of white people necessitates that they project genetic inferiority on people of color, because it is they who really are aware that they are genetic recessive and perhaps genetically inferior to people of color. And I am not saying this to call the condition of skin whiteness to say, well, no, white people are inferior. I'm not saying it for that purpose, but I think that it is of prime importance for the majority of people in the world to understand why it is that white people have to, the effective majority, large numbers of white people, have to move in a hostile and an aggressive way against people of color and have to constantly focus on it's you who's genetically inferior, because they realize that there's something wrong with their genetic status. Now,
may I take a call?
Oh, sure,
all right.
Please.
Let me, so that, because we have a number of calls, And we'll see what the public wants to find out also. Just one second. Hello. Go ahead, please. You're on Black Journal.
Yes, thank you. I would like to ask the question, why does the doctor feel that his theory, Dr. Shockley, why did you feel that your theory is correct?
Well, let me say that's a long question. Let me point out one aspect. It's a question that calls for a very long answer. I think I might just at this point say that in a time like 1 hour, we may expose a problem and encourage thinking about it, and this is a very valuable thing. But to cover either Dr. Welsing's views or mine, and let me say here are, just to show that these things exist, is a pamphlet that she was good enough to give me some time ago.
This one's upside down.
Well, that one's upside down.
Yeah,
thank you.
Right.
And this is one of my own. It's actually a collection of a debate.
The Empiricism of Ethnic Education is yours.
This is the issue of the journal. Mine was, the title of my paper is somewhat different from this, but I want to say that speaking for myself, if people would like to write to me at Stanford University, I have a post box there, post box S, which is the same as Shockley and Stanford. I will try to supply more information, and I'm sure Dr. Welsing will say what she can do about making... telling people how to reach her pamphlet. Okay. But now let me say this chart that I held up a moment ago is very important in respect to this question of why I think there may be what proves a basic difference. But I'm going to say that if there were not a basic difference in intellectual capacity in the past, there probably will be a basic difference between black and white intellectual capacity in the future simply because of the reproduction patterns. And these are Census Bureau data, and this is the most threatening aspect. And what it indicates is that for the black women of the lowest intellectual social class, which are rural farm women, generally the education is least, the average number of children is 5.4. For women with college degrees, it's 1.9. And so this is definitely unfavorable. It is reproducing far more at the bottom end and not enough to keep even at the top end.
Dr. Shockley, can
for whites,
you explain?
Let me just finish this. For whites, the numbers are also in this direction, but nowhere nearly as severe.
Dr. Shockley, I think that in all fairness, you should explain to the audience why it is that you have, first of all, you have a very large segment of the black population who are on farms, who are deprived in cities. Why don't you explain at the time that you're showing this, who is keeping black people in a situation like they're in? I mean, it could be, you could turn it around the other way, where you could have very large numbers of black people who are exposed to educational opportunities like white people, who are exposed to housing, who are exposed to health facilities. Why don't you explain that at the same time that you put figures
like
that?
I'm sure you would explain it, Dr. Welsing. But one must say first things first.
Mm-hmm.
And you've raised the basic question there, and that is whether the disadvantages are primarily a lack of opportunity or whether they are primarily a basic genetic difference. And let me mention one thing, which is that in certain areas there is no doubt about black superiority. Blacks are superior in visual acuity, and they're superior in a systematic way. Now, I don't expect that people will understand the details of this, but I simply want to show that quantitative work can be done. This happens to be a research job of my own. And what it shows, because these points that you see here lie on a line, which is not the central line, but they lie systematically on a line, what it says is that so far as visual acuity is concerned, blacks are systematically better than whites. It's as if their bell-shaped curve, their distribution curve, were pushed upwards compared to whites for visual acuity, or at least for the avoidance of bad eyesight, such that if the same shift occurred for IQ, it would mean that the average IQ distribution would be up by 9 points rather than down by about 15 points, which is the typical average.
Dr. Shockley, visual acuity is probably something that the system of white supremacy has not necessarily seen the need to affect the environment that black people are in so that it will alter the fact that they have visual acuity that is superior to whites. The fact of visual acuity is not attacked in the same way as educational opportunity and job performance is attacked. And I think that
it's evidence for a genetic difference,
in my opinion. See what I'm saying? There might be many, many more genetic differences where people of color appear superior.
If I may, we have a number of people, and we'd like to get to as many as possible. If you could make your answers, as, not to compromise your explanation, right. But if you could make your answers as succinct, I would appreciate it, because we'd like to involve the public as much as we can. One moment, please. You're on Black Journal. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I was wondering if Dr. Shockey could explain the basic difference between his, the course he is taking in explaining white supremacy and the course that Hitler took in during the Nazism reign.
Thank you.
Well, there are enormous differences. In fact, the lesson to be learned from Nazi history is frequently very misunderstood, and it is a lesson which Mr. Brown has told us about earlier. It's the First Amendment. It's not that eugenics is intolerable. Actually, the eugenic programs, which are the opposite of dysgenics, eugenic programs are not inconceivable. They're not inhumane. Denmark has been carrying out programs with strong eugenic implications for maybe 30 years. And it's important to note that since World War II, Denmark's per capita homicide rate dropped and is now approximately 1/20th. That is, the number of deaths of probably being killed in a year by a violent homicide is roughly, oh, the order of 100 times less for young Danes than it is for young American blacks.
Can I?
Now, the lesson of Nazi history we have in this country, and it will protect us. It's just the thing that makes this program possible. The First Amendment, which allows freedom of speech. If one believes that is not the right answer, then one has to be one of the most anti-German racists there can be. If one believes that the German people would have tolerated the concentration camps and the gas chambers, if news media, like the programs that Mr. Brown is setting on, if those people were willing to bring discordant views out in the open, I don't believe the concentration camps and the gas chambers could have continued to exist in Germany.
I'd like to comment, because I'd like to say that I don't think that there's a major difference between what Dr. Shockley is doing. I don't think that Dr. Shockley is fully aware of what he is doing and why he is doing what he's doing. But the long-range implications of what he is doing are no different than the propaganda campaign that Hitler and his Nazi unit carried on in Germany that ended up eliminating 6 million Jewish people. Now, what is most interesting is that Hitler said the very same thing. He said, number one, that the Jews were genetically inferior to the Aryans. Number two, he was aware that the Semites had genetically dominant material, genetic material, to the Aryans. And if we begin to understand the way that people who were in Europe at the time that the Semites arrived from Africa, when the Semites arrived in Europe from Africa, they were people who had substantial amounts of color and who had very kinky hair because they were from the continent of Africa. And the Europeans, the white people who were there, had a reaction, a color reaction, to the Semites that is no different than the reaction and the concern on the part of people who are white in this area of the world or any other area of the world to people who have the genetic capacity to produce color, who can genetically annihilate their position. And I think it's very, very important, even though Dr. Shockley, I am convinced that Dr. Shockley believes that he is perhaps elevating science with all of his charts and all of his figures, but he doesn't understand the things that propel him as a white individual in a social system that has programmed him throughout his life and programmed large numbers of people like him to focus on the genetics of people of color in such a way as to destroy people of color.
I would like to ask a question, and Dr. Shockley, if you could answer it yes or no, I would appreciate it. Do you believe that black people are inferior in intelligence because of their heredity?
I have a standard statement. It is not yes or no. It's memorized. I say it the same time every time, I think. What I say is this. My research leads me, and it's a tragic conclusion, really. My research leads me inescapably to the opinion that the major cause of the American Negro's intellectual and social deficits is hereditary and racially genetic in origin, and thus not remediable to a major degree by practical improvements in environment.
All right. If you believe that the position relatively of black Americans to white Americans is based on a genetic inferiority, and I will accept the responsibility for that word, then what do you see as the solution to the problem?
Well, I see the first aspect of this is to prevent the problem from becoming worse by dysgenics. This first word
would
that
you,
I
translate
that I
dysgenics what for I, me and the audience?
What
would
I
that
meant
be sterilization?
No. Dysgenics, you see, means what that other chart I showed you says.
Should blacks,
that the least effective element.
Should blacks be sterilized?
No. I have a... this
but if
then
blacks
gets
are
into
our
the,
problem and we do not allow...
This is inhumane. And
Dr.
I think
Shapi
one can find more humane solutions to this.
Well, then how would... Then
I would propose something in which one of the key clauses, phrases, is regardless of sex, race, or welfare status. And this is the proposal. I call it a thinking exercise. It's mentioned in that pamphlet that I showed that you can obtain. And it goes this way, that you would offer a bonus to everyone to be sterilized. Now, we know we have a population explosion problem. We know that in India that bonuses in the form of transistor radios are offered to people.
Would this bonus be directed to black people specifically, more
Mr.
than white?
Mr. Brown, what did I say just a moment ago? I said, regardless of sex, race, or welfare status.
Now, there is a group...
Not to shock
there's a group
that's what
of,
I say.
There is a group of white people to whom this offer should be made also.
Absolutely.
Now,
the offer is based upon the best estimates, best scientific estimates, that one can have of any genetically carried disabilities. Now, there are some, I think, that any humane person would have no doubt about. And Dr. Welsing talked about dominant and recessive genes. I want to point out that sometimes a dominant gene can be a very bad thing, and it is a very bad thing, for
color.
A neurological disease called Huntington's chorea, which is something like multiple sclerosis.
Which is more prominent in white people than black people.
That is correct. And I think that one should offer a large bonus for anyone who might be potentially carrying Huntington's chorea.
Dr. Shockley,
beyond this,
you
it goes on with some other factors in this, but Dr. Welsing wishes to speak.
Are you aware that white people have more genetic diseases that affect their nervous system than people of color, than black people?
I wouldn't be at all surprised. And I think
now,
blacks
would you suggest,
have, apparently
would you
have higher
suggest
heart
that all
problems.
Of these, would you suggest that all of these white people who are carrying these defective genes, you know, whose families may carry these defective genes, that they be examined and it would be suggested to them that they be sterilized? Would you suggest this?
Yes, I think I would, probably, in general.
Go ahead. You're on Black Journal, please.
What we know about ancient black civilizations, how can American blacks suddenly be genetically regressive?
Thank you.
Let me just say this. What is very interesting is in the study of biology, biologists who have studied evolution, one of the very interesting things that they say is that the more functional skin pigment cells in the animal kingdom, the higher you are on the scale of phylogenetic ascension. In other words, nature, in the course of evolution, went to its highest state when it produced a cell that could produce pigment, and that we were sliding backwards. The mutation to albinism is a step backwards in the scale of evolution. Are you aware of that, Dr. Shockley?
No.
Well, I'm going to have to discontinue this discussion debate. Well, I don't know if it's a debate or not, but it's titled Debate. Dr. Francis Welsing, WELSING Debate, William Shockley, 1974, Tony Brown Journal. And you'll find this debate on YouTube, along with many other interviews and conferences, recordings, video recordings of Dr. Welsing, if you want to learn more about a what one would consider controversial viewpoints, but I like viewpoints. And I think that there's some truth in many things, even in what Dr. Shockley says. But what is the intent? And I think that she does a really good job approaching that in terms of what is the intent. My guest is calling me now. I'm going to answer the phone. So I'm getting ready for that. Good morning, Deborah. Good morning. Deborah.
Hello.
Hi, how you doing? Hi, Deborah. What's going on here?
Hello.
Hi, Deborah. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Hello.
Hi, Deborah. Can you hear me? Nope. Are we going to do this again? I know this phone is working. Something is not working, though. I'm not quite sure what it is. Okay. Hello, Deborah. Okay, let's hang that up. She's going to try me again, I hope. Okay, the number? Okay, here we go. Hello, Deborah? Nope. It's not working.
Hello?
Hi, Deborah.
It's on.
Hello, Deborah?
Hello?
Hi. This is Eunice. What is... Hello, Deborah? Hello, Deborah? Okay. Not this again. All right. Deborah, what I'm going to ask you to do is I want you to call me on my cell phone again. My number is 217. Okay, Deborah, this is what I want you to do. Okay, let me see here. I'm going to play some music.
Hello.
Hello, Deborah. Hello, Deborah.
Hello.
Deborah, I can hear you, but you can't hear me. I'm not quite sure why that's the case. What I'm going to ask you to do is call my cell number and I'm going to play you on the microphone. All right. I'm so sorry. I'm not quite sure why I'm not getting a connection here. My number is 217-390-1521. 217-390-1521. Hello? Hello, Deborah?
Is this Eunice?
Yes, girl. I have no idea why I'm not able to get... I can hear you really good, but you can't hear me at all. So I have no idea.
Are you at the studio?
Oh, I'm in the studio right now. What we're going to do is we're going to have you just talk through my cell phone.
Okay.
Okay.
So
you're on the air right now.
What would you like me to do?
You're on the air right now.
Okay.
Okay. I have to apologize again because I'm not quite sure why I'm not hearing you. I'm hearing you, but you're not hearing me.
I'm hearing you now?
Yes. Yes, you are. But we're not talking through the station's telephone. We're talking through my cell phone, which I'm very thankful that you called me on. So,
sure.
We're going to do what we got to do, girl. We're going to go ahead.
Okay.
And I'll check on this later and make sure that the next time I invite you on, I will have this, I will know what's happening because I don't know what's happening now.
That is no problem. Do not worry.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Okay.
Of course.
Yes. Yeah, so, anyway, let me just segue myself into this part of my radio show. This is WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and I am Eunice Buckner Boone, and this is Higher Ground. And I have on the phone right now Deborah Havert or Havert?
Havert.
Okay, Deborah Havert. And she is a educator and master trainer for 6 Seconds, the Emotional Intelligence Network, a nonprofit organization dedicated to emotional intelligence. She will suggest a better way for parents to handle stress and loneliness with insights from the organization's new book, Wholehearted Parenting by Joshua Friedman. Now, I have in my hand this book, Wholehearted Parenting, How to Use Emotional Intelligence to Create More Peace, Connection, and Joy. And this book is not just for parents, is it, Deborah?
Right. In fact, it really goes over many of the tools and insights that we use in many trainings. I wholeheartedly recommend this book that Josh has written with a compilation of many tools that he's used, practical tools with his own children.
Okay, so what is your interest in this particular tool? the concept of emotional intelligence or emotional quotient.
You know what I found out? I had lived in Pennsylvania. I now live in Pennsylvania again, outside of Philadelphia. I lived in this area, and I was an administrator at a private school here. And I moved to Houston for a while, and I kept on reflecting back on what is missing in our educational systems, what is missing in parenting skills. And I did a lot of research and came up with, after talking with people from 6 Seconds, in 2004, I decided to take my first training, the 6 Seconds. And I remember coming back from that and thinking, this is the missing piece. Emotional intelligence skills and all of its tools are really missing in some of our schools. Now, many of the schools around the world are now integrating what they call social and emotional learning, which is really emotional intelligence. But as an administrator and a teacher and now a coach and a consultant and so forth, this is the piece that I have found, whether it be in leadership, whether it be in parenting skills, whether it be with friends. I've had gatherings at my home with friends learning these skills.
Okay, so what is emotional intelligence? What is that?
So we like to say it's being smart about feelings, mm-hmm. but I would also say it another way, and that is it's really blending thinking and feeling for optimal decision making for ourselves and for others. And what that means is we really teach in our trainings, with our assessments and so forth, we really teach people about what is really happening in the brain. And what we know is that the feeling part of the brain, the limbic system, and the cortex, which is the thinking part of the brain, in order to make really good decisions, both of those parts need to work together. And so in Josh's book, in fact, Wholehearted Parenting, he does a lot of sharing his own practical ways that he's been using emotional intelligence skills to blend those thinking and feeling together.
Do we need to read a book to blend those limbic and the cortex together?
You know what? In Josh's book is a good start, but also there are many other books. If you go on the 6 Seconds website, which is www.6SECONDS.org, we have a whole EQ bookstore. And there are many books there for leadership, for parents. There are also some hands-on activities. And in fact, since 6 Seconds is so committed to sharing this information, we also do free webinars. We do webinars on parenting, on leadership. We also do classes that are free because we believe that we want, by 2039, we want 1 billion people globally practicing these EQ skills.
Okay, but my question was this, Deborah, and perhaps I didn't phrase it right. I have this naturally, right? This limbic brain and this cortex, right? And they're working the way they should, or you're saying it's not. Why do I need to read this? Okay, go ahead.
That's a really good question, because what happens is we all have our patterns. For instance, I'll give you an example of a pattern. And we're in the car, and we're in traffic. And when I used to live in Houston, there was a lot of traffic. and if you have a child in the car and you're trying to maneuver around the traffic and the child is saying various things, and all of a sudden those hot buttons are pushed. And there you have that limbic system, the amygdala just sort of is trying to protect you. And all of a sudden you may start shouting or you may say, oh, please be quiet and so on. And so we have certain patterns that work for us. There are certain patterns that don't work, such as what I was just talking about, being in the car and starting to shout. And so you're right that we're so fortunate that we have a limbic system in the cortex, but what we want to learn is how to get through those hot button issues. So when somebody, you know, is making you angry, we want to, you know, validate that we feel angry, but go deeper. You know, how are we going to transform that anger so that we can be better for ourselves and others? Mm-hmm. So you're completely right in that we have the resources right there in our brain. We just need to use those resources a little bit better.
So looking at the book here, you have on the page, Joshua has on page 37, decoding the messages. You mentioned an emotion that is oftentimes looked upon as a negative emotion, which is anger, but is referred to here on this page as decoding messages. Anger, disgust, fear. Explain to us, what does that mean? So we have these components in our brains. We have feelings. We have these thoughts. We're reacting to these things, right? But it seems as if in some way we don't quite understand the depth of our feelings, maybe not even aware of what these feelings are, all the things that our feelings are communicating.
Right. In fact, what we like to say is, because this is all data that we're getting, you know, from the brain and from really our whole body, you know, sometimes we feel those gut feelings. Well, that all is important to us. So what we like to say is there are no negative emotions. They're all data. For instance, you mentioned anger. Anger is really telling us that something is blocked, that something is not the way that we want it to be. And so by validating that we're feeling that, that's data that we're getting. Example, I always use this example because I think it's a good one. For instance, if Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I am sure that he felt anger about inequality. And he used that, however, in a constructive way. He felt it, and then he was able to transform it. And this is what leaders do. They navigate their emotions. He was able to navigate through that emotion in order to make it constructive for himself and for others, and, of course, made major strides, not only in our country, but in the world. So these pieces of data that we get, if it's joy, if we have this sense of appreciation for wanting more of that, in fact, we know how to have gratitude. We know how to appreciate in that sense of joy, in that emotion of joy. When we feel, you know, various types of emotions, it's all data. In fact, what we say is thoughts are what we are telling ourselves, feelings are what we are sensing, and actions are what we are doing and how we are behaving. So there's thoughts, feelings, and actions.
Is that the 6 seconds? Are we actually experiencing this in not literally 6 seconds, but we're saying oftentimes we ignore the feelings that are precipitating the thought and the action.
Right.
We're not as aware of that. Why is that? What is it about? Because one of the things my brother used to tell me all the time years ago, my brother said this to me. He said, he kept using the word feelings, and he was singing the song Feelings when he was talking about me. He said,
yes.
You got to feel it with Nacy. You got to feel it. And I am very aware of my feelings. I'm so, not so aware, but meaning I'm aware of how I think about my feelings, how I'm thinking about the way you're sounding to me, how I feel like I sound when I'm saying this to you. What am I, I'm thinking about my thoughts behind it. What are my intentions? What is my body feeling like? What has happened?
This is all good.
Yeah.
Because really, when you have that, when you have really gone deeper with your feelings, that's called emotional literacy. And that's the backbone of emotional intelligence. It means that if you're able to label how you're feeling, it means that you are able to have a broad sense of feelings. It real, and it's going deeper. It's not just saying, well, you know, I feel this way, let's move on and so forth. But it sounds like you already have a great sense of how you were feeling at any particular time.
So my question is, okay, go on.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. By doing?
So by doing that, it starts with us first as individuals. In order to really understand other people and how they're feeling, it has to start with us first. And that's why we call that know yourself pursuit, which is emotional literacy and recognizing our patterns.
Okay, so I got another question. Okay, so need to ask you this question then. What has caused this kind of lack of awareness and intelligence building when it comes to our emotion? What are some of the contributors to this? You see, you're referring to as educators. We're educators, but yet our children are lacking emotional intelligence. And to me, we say emotional intelligence, we're only actually saying connection to the self. It's like a connection to what it is we're doing, why we're doing it. And we don't. And to me, children don't start off like that. We don't start off not being, what is it? Not awareness to our feelings, but very much so responsive to our feelings.
Right. And, you know, what I would say to that is this, is that many times we are all about what's our goal. You know, we want test scores that are high. We want, you know, kids to get into good college if they want to go to college. We are not spending enough time for those face-to-face communication times. We are, and again, I use technology all the time, and I love it. We want to have a balance between face-to-face communication so that we can read body language, which is part of emotional intelligence, so that we can pick up feelings that people are having. We can be aware of hot buttons that our friends and family have, just as we have. So we need that balance. And some children growing up right now are so on the side of screen time, whether that is iPad or computer or TV or phone or whatever, that I'm just saying, and Six Seconds is saying, we need that balance in this digital age. Because unless we have that, we're not picking up the nuances like you are, as you were talking about, that you're really good at picking up feelings and knowing your feelings. And so I would say that when we're really goal-oriented about, you know, in our schools about just, you know, come on, let's just get good test grades, let's just, you know, then we're not spending time. In fact, I might say that many of the Six Seconds education and parent courses that we have, we start off with a check-in. For instance, in a classroom, I was in a classroom yesterday, and I said, you know, how are you feeling? And they sort of looked at me, and I said, 1 to 10, how are you feeling? 10 being you really feel great and you're ready to start your day. And what happens is when you do a check-in like that, it automatically has kids connect. It automatically enables people to feel safe, that you have really connected to me and wanted to know how I'm feeling. But if we just go into a classroom or we're just with our the children and just sort of say, okay, let's go here, let's go on with this class, and not spend time with that connection, we're not connecting as well as we could.
So my question, which was, why are we this way? You're saying it's a lot of it has to do with the screen time. We're more looking at objects as our attention, as opposed to looking at one another. And so I'm asking you a question too, which is, why is that? I mean, I understand that these objects are there. The kids, we don't make the objects. Okay, kids don't make the objects. I'm just saying, okay, they're not making the objects. So before the technology age, what was it then? Okay, what's this has been going on for a while now. Okay, this is disconnect. Yes. And you made a reference to Martin Luther King. So we're looking at, let's say, a person who was angry and angry about a social construct that was everywhere. Okay?
Right.
And I see it. He's okay, let's say this Martin Luther King is saying, I see it. We see it, but you don't see it.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Uh-huh. So let's get a little deeper here. Why is it that we don't see it? Why are we not intelligent? It's an intelligent sale. It's there. We have the emotional quotient. We have this intelligence, but it's underutilized. Why is that?
Right. I think that sometimes in our families, we're not spending enough time with that. We live in very harried lives many times. And I'll give you a tool, in fact, which I think is really wonderful that I know parents do, and that is they sit down and they have a family meeting. And they say, in order for our family to work well, we want to check in with each other. We want to have that dining room time for meals. In fact, some parents say, okay, phones, let's put them in the basket when we go to have dinner. So just having more time to connect is really and really important. That means putting away the technology. I've been in restaurants, and probably you have, where people are having dinner and they're on their phones, not even looking at each other. So that's one thing, is really, just taking time in the family to maybe even come up with some guidelines by which we'll live together. That might mean, remember, putting technology away when we're together. Could be number two, if there's a problem and you want to discuss it, please bring it up and we'll discuss it and we'll take time to problem solve it together. Okay? In schools that don't take enough time with the children, again, if they're all about the test scores and they don't take time to learn these lessons of social and emotional learning, which is really the set of skills in order to be emotionally intelligent, it just becomes, again, very stressful for not only the children but parents because they don't know how their emotions are working.
I want to interrupt a little bit and just make it a little more challenging for me. And that is, what about, I'm feeling, but I don't trust that you care. That's a feeling too. Trust is a feeling. I had a guest on a couple of weeks ago, and the main theme of our conversation was about trust. She wrote a book about the, trust. I can't think of the name of the book right now. But trust is a feeling. Yes, yes. And Lee.
She's my friend.
Oh, awesome. It was a very interesting conversation. Yes. And trust was referred to as a feeling. So trust being a feeling, I feel that you're not listening to me being a feeling, a listening, so you said the eye contact, the sense of being present, that you're interested in what I have to say. It's like all of these experiences are laced with feelings. Okay. So now, so I don't trust that you care about me. So how am I going to do well and how are you going to tap into me doing well or not that I'm not doing well? And you're not just teaching me four scores. If you don't communicate that you care about me.
Right.
Do you understand? So what? Okay. Okay. Go ahead.
So if that would happen, so what I would suggest is this, and again, it's sort of hard if you don't feel safe with someone saying this, but to really have the conversation with that person and say, I'm not so, I I'd love to have a conversation with you, and I'm going to, you might even want to say, I'm going to be vulnerable now.
But this is a child. But I'm talking about in a classroom, because, you know, African Americans, we have, there's a large percentage of children who are of color, you know, who are in, what is it they call after school,
yes,
due to punishment or
programs
that are for punishment purposes in school, punishment, low performance, because of behavioral issues. We have a large percentage of African American children in juvenile detention. This is preparation for prison. We know that there's an enormous number of African Americans in prison too. All right. So we're talking about feelings, right? And feelings are so important, right? So if you ask me, how's my day going? And as a person of color, I might want to talk to you about what it means to be a person of color. That's part of my day too. It may not be part of a child's vocabulary or vernacular to even say or understanding this is what it feels like to be a person of color in this classroom. However, there are issues of feelings that are being communicated within our environments, whether the environment of home, the environment of our neighborhoods, communities, et cetera, all these systems are part of our how am I doing today kind of thing.
Yeah.
So why would you ask me that question? You know, not saying, I'm saying hypothetically, why would you ask me this if you don't really care to hear about how I'm doing?
Well, that's so you were asking, I want to make sure I'm hearing this correctly.
Okay.
So what you're asking is, in the case of asking a child who, let's say, who happens to be African American, to ask them how they're feeling.
Exactly.
That's what you're asking.
Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And so here's the thing. When we talk about emotional intelligence, we're talking about also that having woven through emotional intelligence in any school is this immediate sense that I belong, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you do that? Well, that takes a lot of training of the teachers. But like you were saying, if a child doesn't feel, you know, that they're validated for being there or they're all, a sense of getting into trouble and so forth, woven through any school has to be that sense of I belong and I am valued. And that takes trained teachers and administrators and parents.
And that takes also, I'm just being a little more challenging, if you don't mind. It does also, thank you so much. It also takes an awareness on the teacher's part, the administrator's part, that culture, that they're actually perhaps looking at their anger in a way that is one-dimensional. They're looking at their disgust, or they're looking at their sadness, or whatever they're looking at. Whatever these feelings that they're also bringing to the table, there has to be a greater awareness and a consciousness about what they're experiencing too, in order to even ask someone else, how are they experiencing?
You are completely right. I did a research study in Houston, and I was doing a pre-test and a post-test using an assessment we have called the SAYV, which is an emotional intelligence assessment. It's on self-perception, which means kids are saying how they feel. And what was so interesting is the principal said, oh, yes, you can do this study because these kids get in trouble all the time. And this person said, will you fix them? And I said to the principal, oh, I don't fix anyone. And I didn't want to make the principal feel bad, but I just wanted, I said, we're exploring together. Well, guess what happened through about 2.5 months with these children? These are children who used to resort to, because they had a lot of anger, right? They went home to, sometimes parents were in, you know, in jail, or sometimes they were just a lot of anger about a lot of different things. And here's what happened, and this was so dramatic, after being trained in social-emotional learning. Here's what happened. At the end, I asked them, I said, could you tell me? I want to know your opinion. And again, it is about empowering the children. It is about their opinions. That's what's crucial. It's not me telling them what to do. But here's what happened. A child, at the end, when I said, what's your favorite competency of the skills that we learned, of the eight that we learned? And this child piped in without even thinking. It was just right on the tip of his tongue. He said, pursuing noble goal. He turns to me and he says, I can change the world too, not just you, Mrs. Havert.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the kids start clapping.
Mm-hmm.
And they realized, they said, you know, we can do our part. We can do our part. Can we show empathy? Yes. But we have to work on it the rest of our life, just like you are, Mrs. Havert, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we learn these skills, anyone who thinks that any child anywhere can't learn these skills is mistaken.
So once again, wouldn't it be them? Would it also be that principal, whoever that principal was, his response to it was, fix this. So what are the emotions? What are the thoughts? And what are the actions that that child is being exposed to, not only in his home, but there's all these environments in which emotional intelligence helps when you have this awareness, whether it's a workplace, school environment, community, personal relationships, marriage, parenting, etc., that this child is being exposed to this person whose feelings... What are the feelings? So let's just explore the principal's feelings. What could this principal be experiencing? We don't know about his life at home, but let's just assume, what is his understanding about culture, his feelings about certain cultures, certain individuals, you know? Do you understand what I'm saying here?
Yes. And I think many times, and I was an administrator at two different schools, and I think in this case, there was this sense of, I'm just supposing this. Right. And again, just like you say, we don't know the whole backstory there. But I got a sense that this person was like, just fix it, because I've just really had problems with these kids and I don't know what to do. And that's what it comes down to. I don't know what to do.
But what are you trying to fix? Okay, so let me listen. Come on, I'm going to listen, please.
So here's what I think. Mm-hmm. I think if people don't take the time to really know, just like you were saying, really know the backstories of every single child and where they're coming from, and the challenges they have, and the successes they have, and really know families, and how are they doing with their peers, we're not getting the full story about that child.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not able to help parents. We're not able to, and some parents have fabulous skills, right? But if we don't know the full child, we're only getting part of the story.
But you keep focusing on the child, and I'm saying the focus has to be on that principal too, because the principal said, fix it. And if he's frustrated or she's frustrated and says, fix it, fix what? Fix it so that it looks like me. Fix it so that I don't have to see it. Fix it. What does that mean? And from where is he drawing this energy, these feelings? What is his viewpoint? You know what I mean? I want to know what he thinks. And I think that without that emotional quotient, which is the one that's going to, and according to this book and according to what I know,
is that without that emotional component, we can do almost anything. We can have any thought without examination, and we can act without react and not really see our part in it because our feelings are so disconnected from it.
That's right. And so what we hope for, and it really comes to, you know, we've had many discussions about this. Mm-hmm. In order for children to do well, whether it's in families or schools, churches, synagogues, wherever, mm-hmm. we have to model this.
Yes.
Just like the principal mm-hmm. has to model every day mm-hmm. what it means to be an emotionally intelligent person.
Exactly.
When I used to do trainings at Synapse School in Menlo Park, California, one of my favorite parts of my job was training teachers. And one of my, something that I really loved, if I may share, was I gave each teacher, one year we were starting the year, and I gave each teacher and administrator a lighthouse, a little replica of a lighthouse. And I said, I'm going to invite you this year to shine the light on others. And what I meant by that is, yes, you need to know yourself and so forth and make good choices and then give of yourself. But also we want to shine the light on how can we truly have a culture where everyone is empowered and everyone feels safe and feels trust.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in fact, it was funny throughout the year I would go into classrooms and I'd say, oh, there's your lighthouse. Yes, we keep that symbol here so that we remember that we're shining the light, and that can be a metaphor for many things, but you know, we have to start with the adults. What kind of training do they have in multiculturalism? What training do they have in, you know, this is crucial and is woven through what we do with emotional intelligence. Since we're, 6 Seconds is a global group, it's all about whatever culture you are in, let's get to know each other more. Let's have appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
Let's understand challenges that you have and successes. But it really is going deeper, just like you've been saying. It's deeper and deeper and deeper in order to really know people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that we can trust each other. Because as Lee, my friend, who doesn't live far from me, as a matter of fact, if we don't have the trust, then that child, if I may go back to that child, who is sitting there and we're asking that child, what is he or she feeling? They don't have trust. They don't want to tell you.
Mm.
You know?
Mm. That's so true.
It's real. Do you really care about me?
Mm-hmm.
Or are these, do we have prejudices
mm-hmm.
around mm-hmm. who you think I am?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You see?
Mm-hmm. And that awareness, the self-awareness, is also crucial to the communication of the question, how this
yes.
question is actually communicated. You can ask a question, but that awareness of how that question is resonating from within you is also
right.
part of the communication. And
so what if, yeah.
Go on.
And so if a child, and this is what happens many times, we're so used to doing this because we always want to just sort of make things better.
Mm.
If a child says, and this happened before in various situations, a child might say, 1 to 10 today, this morning, I'm a 2. And you sort of look at them and you want to right away say, oh, no, you don't feel that way.
Mm.
And what we want to have happen is that child can say, I'm feeling like a 2 right now. You may want to say to that child, depending on the age and so forth, might want to say, you want to talk about that later, we can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they may not want to say it in front of the group because let's say something happened at home and they're really sad or they're angry or something mm-hmm. is happening that's not happening in school, but they feel that way. And many times we say to a child later in the day, are you still feeling that way? And here's what has happened many times, which is so amazing about kids showing empathy to each other. Do you know that I've seen other children will go up to that child who said he or she was a two, and they put arms around that child and say, can I help?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything I can do?
Mm-hmm.
That is that empathy in action, mm-hmm. which is crucial in what we want kids to learn.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to the principle we talked about,
mm-hmm.
empathy is crucial to any culture of any school, corporation, family. It is crucial that we feel that empathy, that curiosity about each other, that sense of I'm here for you. And some children and adults are not feeling that at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, too. I thought about how emotional intelligence also means corrective. I'm willing to change something. I'm willing to look at this differently for the good of myself, my own self-development, my own empathic intelligence quotient, or my own humanity. But I'm willing to do that for myself. And I know that if I do this for myself, I'll do that for you too. There's a corrective response that is so vital as opposed to a reactionary one.
Right. Because what I always loved when I first got trained in 2004, what I found so interesting, and you've been mentioning it, and that is we want to be able to respond rather than react.
Mm-hmm.
Because the amygdala in our brain is all about survival. And so we want to be able to use all the parts of our brain, but we also want to take the time and, you know, to really respond rather than react. Because sometimes when we're in reaction, we're not making the right choice.
Mm. But then
we develop sometimes, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's that empathy, though. Empathy is not just for the other person, it's for yourself.
Exactly.
And one of the things I was reading in the book is that all the errors, you know, that the author of Wholehearted Parenting, Joshua Freeman, says, you know, making errors as a parent. But I have two daughters that I, you know, they're adult children now. But I've learned so much about my emotions and my feelings and how I look at things through my children. As I've made decisions and I've responded or reacted, because that's what we do. So even there's a reaction and there's a responsive action. All of it, if you understand emotional intelligence, it's not condemning any of it. It's awareness of it. And that I can make a change or a shift based on the experience that I'm having now. So I can do it differently. And I'll be not necessarily the same, because the same experience is not going to occur exactly the same. But there is there's information, like you said, there's data in that I can use.
That's right. So committing to I can change, just like you were saying. That, in fact, I always say this story about my stepmother, who is since deceased, but in her 83 years, she said to me, and she had cancer at the time, and she said, I'm choosing to be optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, does that come easily to you? She said, no. Now, she lives for longer than she thought. But do you know what I'm saying? It was that sense of, and I love Dr. Martin Seligman's work of TIE.
Mm-hmm.
Any adversity is temporary. That's the T. I is isolated. And E, here's the part that is about change, effort can be put into changing it.
Mm-hmm.
This tool, TIE, is one of the, I would have to say, one of the most popular tools that I've used with adults and kids of all ages, because it makes sense that I can use my optimistic thinking to look at any adversity as temporary, it's isolated, only one part of my life, and E, effort can be put into changing it. It's about change.
Yeah. It's empowering. You could say that E is empowering too, because
yes, I love that. I'm going to have to use that now. I like that a lot.
Oh yeah,
because
oh, yeah.
That's what we want mm-hmm. for adults and children.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm so enjoying. If I must say, I'm so enjoying your questions. Mm. They're such great ones.
Well, you know what? This is something that. It's very interesting. Whenever I read something or I'm experiencing something, I immediately want to see its usefulness. It's like, well, okay, how do I utilize
yes.
it? You know, if it's not something, and I said, well, I'm already utilizing it, but it's not a program. It's not this, it's not that. But I'm going to share with you an experience. I'm going to share with you experience that I had yesterday. I think it was yesterday. Well, I can't remember when it was. But it was something that I said to my husband, and this is a conversation, because my husband has said to me many times that he was just numb to his feelings, and he's a veteran. So when you think of in terms of reasons why he may be numb,
right.
These would be some of his reasons. Okay. So that's one uh-huh. and being some other factors and da, da, da. So being a person who a woman, and it says, well, women are emotional, right? It's okay for women to be emotional, but it's okay for you to be numb. Even though he says I'm numb, but it's still okay for you to be that way. So when he would ask me something, he would not ask me as if he would insert himself in it. Like he would say, do you want to go to the show with me? Not, I want you to go to the show. Do you want to go for a walk with me? Not, I want you to go for a walk with me.
I see, yeah.
And we've been married over 30 something years, right? And in that
congrats.
Has been, but let me say this. This is peeling back, because it's so easy to not feel. And when you don't feel,
right.
You can hurt someone and not even be aware of it. You can see them hurting. You can see them longing for you, but not be aware
right.
of their longing for you. You transmit it into weakness, vulnerability. You know, you're just doing what you do. So it was interesting. We've had many, many discussions. And this recent one was, he asked me to pick him up from somewhere, which wasn't too far from where he had to be, all right? But that wasn't the issue. The question was, I want you to come and pick me up from where I'm at so I can pick up my car from where it's getting work done on it. So I said, and I noticed when I said it, I was very aware, Deborah, of my response, because I was wanting to be very clear, and at the same time, I didn't mind, and I wanted to communicate the feeling that goes along with actions, because all of our actions have feelings connected to them. How some people say, oh, you're just doing your job. It's your job. You're doing it. You're a therapist. You're doing your job to care, to listen, to da, da, da. You're a parent. You're supposed to. No, it's not just that. So anyway, so I said to him, he said, would you mind coming to pick me up? I said, no, I would not mind picking you up. I will pick you up. What time do you want me to pick you up? So he told me what time he wanted me to pick him up. And I wanted to make a point that I was going to be closer to being on time rather than being late. 2 minutes before the time that I said I would pick him up, he calls me and he says, you don't have to pick me. I hope you're not coming to pick me up. Now, I'm almost there. He says, I hope you're not here to pick me. I hope you're not on your way to pick me up. I took that as, I don't need you now. I have something else to do. I have someone else I can depend on. It's a nice day. I can go walk without you. I don't need you. Now, he may not have been saying all of that, but there have been conversations in which he did say that. And I did not recognize it sometimes. I reacted. I took it personal. And my response to it was, what else do I have to do in order for you to acknowledge that what I do for you is not because you're asking me only to do it and I'm just doing something. I'm doing it because I care. I'm doing it even when you don't ask me because I care. So I said to him, while I was on the phone, I said, I hope you're not saying you hope that I'm not coming when you ask me to do something for you. If you ask me to do something, I didn't see all this, but if you ask me to do something, I'm sure you're not hoping I'm not going to do it when I say I am. What ensued after that, the conversation after that, I communicated in a very angry tone how I felt about that, because I wanted him to understand that when you, it's so easy for us, and it's also easy for me to be angry. But sometimes the anger serves a purpose, which is to be emphatic about this. We do things for each other, not because I'm lacking something and not because you do, but because we want to. And we are fully aware and paying attention, not in a manipulative way, and not in a way of trying to get you to stick around and hang out and be there and attach yourself to me and or me to you. We're not weak. We're empowered here. And anything that you do, that I do for you, I'm well aware that I'm doing it. And anything that you receive from me, I want you to be well aware of how I'm giving it to you. You are entitled to that. And so...
Interesting.
Go on.
And, you know, and that's the thing. He may not have even thought. You know, it's about perception.
Yeah.
And we have to value that you have a different perception than he has.
That's right.
And we're not always aware of our words.
That's right. That's right.
And the power of those words, whether they be not really tuning into someone or whatever, but... we have different perceptions.
That's right.
And that's why the conversation after something like that is really crucial, so that someone can understand, you know, I didn't even know you thought that. I was just trying to say this. You know, by having that conversation and, you know, sometimes we just don't want it to, you know, because we think it's going to be conflict or something. But instead, then we have the pattern continue.
Right.
We have the conversation.
That's right. And to trust that what you're talking about here in terms of increasing, turning up the emotional quotient in myself, understanding myself deeper, that it's actually going to mean something. And if I'm not convinced, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it for me, and I'm not going to do it for you. And unless I am convinced, then there's no reason. There's no reason for us to have this conversation. It doesn't really matter. It's not enough for us to have diversity training and all these different programs if people don't utilize the concepts.
Exactly.
And these are things that are already within us, but they're untapped.
Right.
They're untapped, consciously untapped. And they're becoming unconscious in a sense that we don't really necessarily see that it's important that we should develop these skills, develop our insights, to be open to this. And so that's why it's really mandatory, Deborah, I say this, it's mandatory within my own life that I do this. First with myself, and then the next person who's my husband. It doesn't mean anything to me if I have... like this sort of stewardship over myself. And then I have the stewardship over my husband and the stewardship with my dog, but I don't take care of it. It's important to me that I be a steward of what is before me, what is in front of me.
Right. And in fact, so if we could have families really start taking this seriously saying, by doing this in my family, you are really role modeling also for others.
That's right.
When you go out into the world, you're role modeling. You probably have had this. I've already had where someone said, I can't believe how you just handled that. And I said, I've been working on it, you know. It does, you know, I'm working on it because I've delved deeper. But they pick up on it. They pick up on it. And, you know, even though, you know, I'm making mistakes every day, I mean, we're all working on it, right?
Empathy.
Yes. And so I think that the more that we can, and again, that trust, you know, has to be developed there, the more that we can learn these, and it starts with the self-awareness, then the self-management, and then the self-direction. But the more that we can work on these skills, the deeper that we go, which you have done so skillfully with the questions, the better it's going to be for all of us.
Yes, yes, yes. It's better for you, even though you're way over there. It's better for me, even though you're way over there.
Right.
Because I'm taking care of that which is in front of me, and that is me when I look at myself, that reflection of who I am, and then how I'm treating those within my care, immediate care. And and that, and then it extends outward because there's that awareness, there's a consciousness that is there at all times about how am I doing. It doesn't mean I have to do it perfectly. It doesn't mean that every relationship is easy and that it's conflict-free and kumbaya. No, it does not. It means that I'm willing, I'm willing to accept all of my humanity and my understanding of myself. And that, with that capacity, I'm willing to challenge me. And I'll challenge you too. Just because I challenge myself. Because the challenge is there, and I'm there to accept it and welcome it. We've got to go. I've got to get myself out of here, out of this seat.
Oh, this is wonderful. Thank you.
Hey, it's been wonderful too for me too. So we were talking with Deborah Havert. Or did I say Havert? I'm sorry, I keep forgetting.
Havert, yeah.
Okay, Deborah Havert, who is the educator and master trainer for 6 Seconds, the Emotional Intelligence Network, a nonprofit organization dedicated to emotional intelligence. And so if people are interested in getting this book, it's called Wholehearted Parenting, How to Use Emotional Intelligence to Create More Peace, Connection, and Joy by Joshua Friedman. And they can also go to the website. And what is that website again, Deborah?
It's www.6seconds, secondsSeconds.org. You can get the book there or on Amazon, and I heartily recommend it.
Thank you so much, Deborah. If I can be of service to you in the future, please keep me in mind. You can always call me. You have my cell number, too, and make an appointment to be on Higher Ground again. I would love to continue this discussion and talk about maybe some of the current events that are going on. I think we've done that in a way, too, but I think this is a good conversation, and it's a good topic, and I think it serves many useful areas of our life, and I think it's so important.
It was a pleasure meeting with you.
You too. It's been a pleasure, and please tell Lee I said hi. I've not stopped talking about her. Hey, ask her if she would send me that book again, because I never got mine. Sorry for the pitch, but just tell her.
I will.
All righty. Take care, Deborah.
You too. Thanks so much. Have a good weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I have no idea why my phone is not working. I mean, not my phone, but I can't get...
The interface is out for some reason.
Oh, is that it?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, I don't know either. Because last time I was on, I had to do the same thing.
I could hear her, but not, she couldn't hear you.
Yeah.
There's something called the clean feed, but I don't know.
Okay, so I have to check on that before.
It should all be off the air, you know, of course.
Yeah.
Just trying to talk.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check on this. So what would I say this is about? Emotional quotients, emotional intelligence?
Well, you just do a disclaimer.
Staying aware.
Opinions that,
yeah, I did do that.
Reflect others here at the station.
Yeah, I'm just trying to come up with a topic. You know, topic of what?
Yeah, okay.
Okay. I already did my disclaimer.
Well, that'll count for me then.